This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
Brain replaced by something with only the side of my nose for company. These and those and them ones.
Next on What's the Frequency, Kenneth?
Ruth, I'd love to do an infrastructure bill. I'm not interested in raising taxes.
It'll come to me. Brain replaced by something. With only the side of my
across the board on America, I think it will send our economy in the wrong direction.
Them ones, what you call it. The unnameable.
Hopefully, they don't choose that path, but they may.
I'm Paul Fisher.
Head.
Take long for Republicans to start attacking the Biden infrastructure plan.
With a combination of massive tax increases on businesses and individuals and more borrowing to add even more to the $2 trillion national debt. I think that's a big mistake, and I think that package that they're putting together now, as much as we would like to address infrastructure, is not going to get support from our side. And I'm going to fight them every step of the way because I think this is the wrong prescription for America.
And what do you think of the U.S. administration? How do you think he's doing? I mean, President Biden had a lot of ambitious goals coming in, especially for his first 100 days.
Well, I like him personally. I mean, we've been friends for a long time. He's a first-rate person. Nevertheless.
Brain replaced by something.
This is a bold left-wing administration. I don't think they have a mandate to do what they're doing. Admittedly, the president was not reelected, the previous president. But if you look at the results in Congress, a 50-50 Senate and maybe a three-vote majority in the House, I don't think the American people gave them a mandate to drive our country all the way to the political left. Deterred by that, and they're going to try to do it anyway. And I'm going to fight them every step of the way because I think this is the wrong prescription for America.
To the American people.
Is there a risk, sir, if raising taxes could slow the economy?
Raising taxes, the studies show, will not slow the economy at all. Asking corporate America just to pay their fair share will not slow the economy at all. It will make the economy function better and will create more energy.
With the
Republicans argue that we don't need infrastructure. It need not. They've been talking about the need for it for years now. If the Republicans decide that We need it, but they're not going to pay for it. It's just going to increase the deficit. If the Republicans say the next phase of my plan, we don't need to invest in VA hospitals and keep the sacred obligation we made to so many Americans. If the Republicans say that the 400,000 homes and our schools and daycare centers that have lead pipes delivering water to their doors, if they say we shouldn't be doing that, what do you think would happen if they found out all the lead pipes were up in the Capitol and every time they turned on the water fountain? So I think we're going to have I think the Republicans voters are going to have a lot to say about whether we get a lot of this done.
If you think the GOP opposition to the infrastructure plan is purely Trumpian in nature, maybe not.
So sorry, missed the party. Hello on the dark side of the moon.
Sure, under Trump and company, government is the enemy. But it wasn't Trump, it was Ronald Reagan who said this.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Never mind that it was Republicans like Eisenhower who used big government to build the interstate highway system, or Lincoln to build the railroads. And let's not forget NASA and the space race. In other words, big government wasn't always considered bad government. And rebuilding the nation's infrastructure now may have considerable bipartisan support among voters. It just doesn't have bipartisan support from GOP members in Congress, who on the one hand are worried about the deficit they ran up during 4 years of Trump, and who worry on the other hand about raising the taxes they cut on the rich to pay for infrastructure.
Republicans and Democrats historically have wanted to see infrastructure spending on broadband, which this bill includes, wanted to see infrastructure spending on water and removing lead from water systems, which this bill includes. But this is the American Jobs Act, so it's also focused on creating good-paying, sustainable jobs in a whole array of sectors that will help us to win the future. It's the biggest investment in America since FDR, since the New Deal. I look at this from being a former governor of a manufacturing state, Jake. The investments in the supply chain for manufacturing, you know that for decades now we have watched our manufacturing jobs leave. We're at a 70-year low. This bill says we're going to make stuff in America. Mm-hmm. We're going to make the means to our own energy security. It is an amazing statement that finally we're going to invest in America instead of watching all of these other countries beat us to the point.
Well, there's no doubt that Mississippi could use our fair share of $100 billion.
God's a peanut, singing Mississippi, good goddamn.
The problem with this particular plan, though, is although the Biden administration is calling it an infrastructure plan, it looks more like a $2 trillion tax hike plan to me. That's going to lead to significant challenges in our economy. It's going to lead to a slowing GDP, and it's going to lead to Americans losing significant numbers of jobs. Infrastructure, Jake, is an area where Republicans and Democrats ought to be able to come together and do something good for the country. But as you mentioned, this plan spends $110 billion on roads and bridges and spends more than that on the combination of Amtrak and public transit. And what's even worse, it spends $100 billion on clean water, which Mississippi could certainly use, but it spends more than that on subsidizing electric vehicles. $155 billion to subsidize electric vehicles. That is a political statement. It's not a statement on trying to improve our infrastructure in America.
Well, the need to make sure that we have an electrified transportation system to reduce climate change is highly supported and very necessary. And so what does that mean? I mean, it means that we have to build the batteries for those electric vehicles. It gets back to manufacturing. Part of that investment is making sure that we can build the batteries in the U.S. for electrifying transportation and for energy storage instead of getting those batteries from our economic competitors. You know, China has had came out with their most recent 5-year plan, and they have a plan to corner the market on the supply chain for batteries. Okay, we can just sit there and watch that happen,
right?
Or we can decide, no, we want to build that stuff here, and that's part of the investment in the electric vehicle infrastructure.
I think there's an easy win here for the White House if they would take that win. Just make this an infrastructure package, which is about 30%. Even if you stretch the definition of infrastructure some, it's about 30% of the $2.25 trillion they're talking about spending. My advice to the White House has been take that bipartisan win. Do this in a more traditional infrastructure way. And then if you want to force the rest of the package on Republicans in the Congress and the country, you could certainly do that. You'd still have all the tools available for what is clearly going to turn out to be another purely partisan exercise. I think it's a big mistake for the administration. They know I think it's a mistake, and I also think it would be an easy victory if we go back and look at roads and bridges and ports and airports. And maybe even underground water systems and broadband. You'd still be talking about less than 30% of this entire package, and it's an easily doable 30%, I think, Chris.
Well, I'm not going to get ahead of the process in Congress, but what I will say is that the vision the president has put forward is fully paid for. Across 15 years, it would raise all of the revenue needed for these once-in-a-lifetime investments. So by year 16, you'd actually see this package working to reduce the deficit. And again, it's important to point out that the American people agree with this because we've seen corporations paying zero. We're just asking corporations to pay their fair share at a rate, by the way, that would be lower than it's been for most of my life. Again, if folks on the Hill have other ideas about how to pay for it, we're going to be interested to hear those ideas. But there is a clear vision to pay for this bill.
The jobs number that we got yesterday that suggested that over 900,000 jobs were created last month is such great news. It suggests that the economy is slowly starting to reopen. We still have a long way to go. We still have 8.4 million jobs fewer than we had this time last year. I personally believe that what this reflects is this accelerated speed with which we've been rolling out the vaccinations and which people have become vaccinated, the confidence that people have that we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. But I do want to highlight we're not there yet. This was, we had a dramatic loss of jobs over the past year, and the pandemic is still with us. We still have the variants. So this was fabulous news, but we're not quite there yet. You know, the second part of your question was, well, why do we need the American Jobs Plan on top of this? Well, the American Rescue Plan was about getting to the end of the pandemic. That's what it was. It was a rescue. It was to ensure that people had money to put food on the table, pay their rent, that businesses had some money to try to get through to the other side, that the state and local governments had the resources they needed to get us to the other side of this. And to support the dissemination of the vaccines in the first place. Jobs Plan is fundamentally about saying, okay, we've got an economy which, is doing okay. So we're back to what an economist would call full employment. But we need to do better. This country has not been investing in our infrastructure, in our R&D, in our workforce for decades. And we will not continue to be able to grow our economy to ensure that we've got the maximum amount of capacity out of our economies possible and that growth is widely shared. We will not remain the number one economy in the world unless we make these critical investments at this time.
Well, this is $2.25 trillion over 8 years. For context, because these huge numbers are hard to understand, for context, we passed an almost $2 trillion COVID relief package that's supposed to last us 1 year. With some provisions lasting up to 2 years. So the $1,400 stimulus checks, that big package that we felt in our lives, were deployed on a shorter timeline. We need to really have some shorter timelines, some urgency, greater urgency in this package. And I think that some of these investments need to be greater. So for example, let's take public housing. This plan, this Build Back Better plan, it advocates for a total national investment of $40 billion in public housing nationwide. Sounds great, right? you consider the fact that the New York City public housing system needs $40 billion alone just to get up to code. Invest in national public housing infrastructure, we need to do way more in order for us to deliver on this promise in terms of a price tag there.
Well, you'll have to talk to Mr. Manchin, but I think that at the end of the day, you know, you got 50 Democrats in the caucus, so any one of them can say, you know, I'm not supporting this. Understand that in this unprecedented moment in American history, when we have gone through the worst year in the modern history of this country, with so many people dying and getting sick, and our economy tanking, that we have got to work with the president. On an agenda that speaks to the needs of the working class and the middle class and low-income people. For so many years, really had their needs ignored. So I am confident, look, there are differences of opinion. Every one of the Democrats has a different point of view. But at the end of the day, I think Chuck Schumer has been doing a good job. To bring people together. To say, you know what, the future of America is at stake. The future of American democracy is at stake. Because because so many people have reached the conclusion the government doesn't address their needs. Working people are working longer hours for low wages. We have got to speak to that pain that's out there. And if your question is, do I think we're going to come together to do it? Yes, I do.
And I'm proud of that. I appreciate all your time. Thank you very much.
What about Representative Gates?
What about?
There's talk of him in allegations regarding a young girl.
There's talk of that
position of leader. Are you still supporting him? Are you talking to him about it? Where does things stand right now?
There's a New York Times story that I read. I haven't been able to talk to Mr. Gates yet. Mr. Gates denies the story, but I look forward to talking to Mr. Gates. I haven't heard anything from the DOJ or others, but I will deal with it if any of it comes to be true.
Should he remain in his seat?
Thank you.
He just knew it, that as a cheap purveyor of Trump-style theatrics, Trump Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida would risk being undone by them. The first hint of it came when stories surfaced that Gaetz was thinking about leaving Congress to take a media job at Newsmax, which didn't make much sense as a career move. Hours later, two bombshells: that Gaetz was under investigation for possible sex trafficking involving an underage girl, and a claim by Gaetz himself that his family was being extorted to make the investigation go away. Even more bizarre, that the blackmailers wanted the money to pay for a covert op to break an imprisoned American, long thought probably dead, out of a secret dungeon in Iran. Shades of Iran-Contra. As if that weren't enough, the investigation of Gaetz for sex with underage girls was started under Trump Attorney General Bill Barr's watch, months before Biden took office.
It may seem funny.
And the investigation of Gaetz is apparently an outgrowth of charges against a close friend of Gaetz, a local Florida politician who, among other things, is now charged with sex trafficking, identity fraud, and stalking. Lo and behold, later reports say Gaetz may have been involved with some of the same underage girls and using internet apps to make payments
to
them.
Will you take any action to remove Matt Gaetz from the Judiciary Committee while he's under investigation by the DOJ over whether he had a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old and paid for her to travel with him? That's something he denies, but that would be a violation of federal sex trafficking laws.
I haven't heard from DOJ. I haven't been able to talk to Matt Gaetz yet. I just read the story. Those are serious implications. If it comes out to be true, yes, we would remove him if that was the case. But right now, as Matt Gaetz says, it is not true, and we don't have any information. So let's get all the information.
There's also this. Gaetz was the only House member to vote against a measure in 2017 aimed at fighting sex traffickers.
Do you have any idea why Congressman Gates was the only Republican to vote against the federal government and in terms of the trafficking money, the funds?
For human trafficking? No. No, I have no idea whatsoever why he would vote against that.
Have you spoken to him since the news broke last night?
I have not been able to talk to Matt Gaetz yet. I hopefully be able to talk to him today. I've been traveling. We're going to a vaccination facility here just shortly. But later this afternoon, I'm hoping to be able to speak with Mr. Gaetz.
Given the allegations against Matt Gaetz, do you think he should still remain a member of Congress? Should he step down? And if anything, should he be removed from judiciary?
Well, we have so much going on in our country that hopefully we will get back to. But in terms of that, and I think it's an important issue, the integrity of the Congress, not to minimize that. It just surprised me that that was the first question, and I'm barely surprised. If in fact these allegations are true, of course, being removed from the Judiciary Committee is the least that could be done. But again, I think from what we've heard so far, this would be a matter for the Ethics Committee.
Hello, I'm Dan Rather, and you're listening to What's the Frequency, Kenneth? With musical host Paul Fisher in New York City.
During my time covering politics, including my decades at CBS News, the Republican campaign mantra was mostly to portray Democrats as outside the mainstream of American thinking. Now it's Trump and his GOP allies in Congress who are portrayed that way, and with Republicans passing voter suppression laws around the country, even corporate America is bending to pressure to denounce it. Case in point, Georgia's new election law being denounced by Georgia-based Coke and Delta CEO Ed Bastian, among others.
You know, it's been a frustrating few weeks for all of us here in the state of Georgia. As the process unfolded, it was moving quickly. There were a lot of changes. Our team was in there, absolutely, expressing our points of view, making significant improvements to what had been proposed. But when we got a chance to finally see it all put together and had a chance to digest it, as well as listen and hear from the voices of our people about it, we realized that this was restricting their access, our people's access, particularly in the black community. And it did not step forward. It's important that we take a step forward here.
What made you decide to join up?
Well, it was a natural thing for anybody when I was asking for recruits to go overseas.
In terms of a society that is so polarized, you know, the right to vote is sacrosanct, and we can't do anything to send a message to people that we're going to make it more restrictive and harder to have their voice heard.
Major League Baseball reacted by moving the All-Star game out of Atlanta.
I think today's professional athletes are acting incredibly responsible. I would strongly support them doing that. The very people who are victimized the most are the people who are the leaders in these various sports. And it's just not right. This is Jim Crow on steroids.
It's terrible for the fans. It's terrible for the small business owners in the metro Atlanta community in our state that was looking forward to hosting this game and it put a lot of resources into it, all because of a big lie. This is just the cancel culture.
You can't say anything against Hugo. You can't say anything against Hugo. You can't say anything against Hugo.
Did your parents say anything against you going? Did your parents say anything against you going? Did your parents say anything against you going? Parents say anything against you going? Did your parents say?
And I will tell you, the people at home should be scared because their ball game is next. Their business will be next. Their way of life will be next. It is time to stand up and fight this and just say, look, we are not going to take this anymore. It's ridiculous.
To concerns that such moves hurt Georgia's economy in general, and Atlanta's black-owned businesses in particular, the mayor of Atlanta, Keisha Lance Bottoms, says this.
Well, rather than coming here with a particular family, you'd go over and fight them over there on their ground, fight them over there on their ground.
Well, I can't say that I like it, but I certainly understand it. And it is really probably the first of many boycotts of our state to come. And the consequences of this bill are significant. The Metro Atlanta area is home to nearly 30 Fortune 500 companies. We have a very large tourism industry.
What made you decide to join up?
Well, it was a natural thing for anybody here
in our state. And just as the legislators and the governor made the decision, the legislators and the governor made the decision to go forward with this bill, people are making decisions not to come to our state. And it is going to impact millions of Georgians. Employment, small businesses, our corporations, and it's very unfortunate.
In your masculine self-denial, you cancel your Netflix trial, sleep on the floor.
They absolutely have an opportunity to change this law. So they have just ended the normal legislative session. They can go back into special session and make tweaks. They also have an opportunity to revisit this in January.
I'm sending down my pride. It's gonna take a while.
And it's unfortunate because there have been so many issues with our elections across the state. This was an opportunity to fix those things that have gone wrong. This was an opportunity to be a model for the rest of the country on how you can continue to expand absentee voting, how you can expand access to the ballot box. But instead, we dialed it back simply because one party lost. It's a horrible example for the rest of the country, and people are going to show us exactly how they feel by keeping their dollars out of this state. And the irony of that is that, Georgia opened up early in the name of economic recovery. So you put us at risk in the middle of a pandemic to open up the state for economic recovery. And now you wipe that all away with this absolutely insane voting law that was signed into law by the governor.
Keep your eye on your phone.
Thank you.
emotional impact of the trial of Derek Chauvin is undeniable. And it's not just the tape replay of George Floyd's death. There's also the stark contrast between the prosecution witnesses who told the jury they're haunted by guilt for not doing more to make Chauvin stop, and Chauvin's defense that he's not guilty of anything and was afraid of the bystanders yelling at him to stop. But there's more than raw emotion. The trial has cracked the blue wall, with police witnesses for the prosecution saying, yes, Chauvin did do something wrong.
Do you have an opinion as to when the restraint of Mr. Floyd should have ended in this encounter?
Yes.
What is it? When Mr. Floyd was no longer offering up any resistance to the officers, they could have ended their restraint.
And that was after he was handcuffed and on the ground and no longer resisting.
Correct.
Is that, if that were done, would that be considered force?
Absolutely.
What level of force might that be?
That would be the top tier, the deadly force.
Why?
Because of the fact that if your knee is on a person's neck, that can kill them.
And in your training with the Minneapolis Police Department over the years, have you received training on restraining people?
Yes.
Including the use of handcuffs?
Yes.
And when you are handcuffing somebody, when you handcuff them, what is your responsibility as an officer? With regard to that person?
Well, could I give you an example?
Okay. Let me ask you this again. If you, as an officer, according to the training, you handcuff somebody behind the back, what's your responsibility with regard to that person from that moment on?
That person is yours. He's your responsibility. His safety is your responsibility. His well-being is your responsibility.
What is your view of that use of force during that time period?
Totally unnecessary.
Is what you see in Exhibit 17, in your opinion, within Minneapolis Police Departmental Policy 5-300, authorizing the use of reasonable force?
It is not.
And why not?
It has to be objectively reasonable. We have to take into account circumstances, information, the threat to the officer, the threat to others, and the severity of that. So that is not part of our policy. That is not what we teach and that should be condoned.
When do you believe, or do you have a belief as to when this restraint, the restraint on the ground that you viewed, should have stopped?
Once Mr. Floyd, and this is based on my viewing of the videos, once Mr. Floyd had stopped resisting, and certainly once he was in distress and trying to verbalize that, that should have stopped. There's an initial reasonableness in trying to just get him under control over the in the first few seconds, but once there was no longer any resistance, and clearly when Mr. Floyd was no longer responsive and even motionless, to continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy. It's not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
Sir, based on your review of the video and based on your own experience and training as an MPD officer, did you see signs during the encounter that Mr. Floyd was exhibiting indicia of being in medical distress?
Yes. Yes.
And you saw at one point, I think you just testified, that Mr. Floyd was unresponsive.
That is correct.
And that officers, were you aware that officers couldn't find a pulse?
Could you repeat that, sir?
And were you aware that officers at the time of the restraint were unable to find a pulse?
Yes, I was aware of that.
So stated.
I was aware that the officers were not able to find a pulse. Yes.
Did you see the defendant or any of the officers attempt to provide first aid to Mr. Floyd?
I did not see any of the defendants try to attempt to provide first aid to Mr. Floyd.
The defendant did not try CPR. He did not start chest compressions.
Stan is leading. Rephrase.
Did you see them did you see them provide any medical attention?
I did not.
Then, based on Lily's observations, do you have an opinion as to whether the defendant violated MPD Departmental Policy 7-350 by failing to render aid to Mr. Floyd?
I agree that the defendant violated our policy in terms of rendering aid.
Thank you. I have no further questions at this time, Your Honor.
It is with a heavy heart that I come here this afternoon to shed some light on the incident that occurred at the United States Capitol.
Ever since the January 6th attack on the Capitol, it was only a matter of time before someone would try something there again for some reason or other.
At approximately 1:02 hours this afternoon, a suspect entered what we refer to as the North Barricade of the Capitol. The suspect rammed his car into two of our officers. And then hit the North Barricade barrier. At such time, the suspect exited the vehicle with a knife in hand. At this time, the suspect has been pronounced deceased. U.S. Capitol police officers were transported to two different hospitals, and it is with a very, very heavy heart that I announce one of our officers has succumbed to his injuries.
Even as former President Trump and GOP allies in Congress have declared the threat to the Capitol is over or was overblown, and rewriting history to claim there was no insurrection, General Russell Honoré studied the insurrection and called for better security at the Capitol.
We turned in a 78-page report with over 100 recommendations. Some of those recommendations have been adopted. And they're being acted on. The others are waiting supplemental funding. One, we need to tighten up our intelligence analysis teams inside the Capitol Police working with the interagency by expanding the number of trained analysts we have. The next was to increase the number of police officers. The Capitol Police are in a dilemma right now because they're 233 officers short. That is exacerbated by last year COVID pandemic, where they were not able to have an academy class. And so they didn't graduate anyone last year from the academy. That is going to have to be followed up with an incentive to get people to join the police force, as well as to have an extensive recruiting effort. And they know what they got to do. They need the funding from the Congress in the area of the fundamental, the upper supplemental. They also need to add officers to be able to provide security to members while they travel in that home, those that are under direct threat. They need to add the recommended fencing. But they also need protection from a variety of threats, whether it's an individual lone wolf or it is a First Amendment event that turns into a civil disobedience or into a riot.
Thank you. And on What's the Frequency, Kenneth? Trials and tribulations and legislation. For the complete playlist of music and sound bites on the program, you can go to the program's Facebook page, What's the Frequency, Paul. List of the music I played. Started off with More Big Birds by Dry Cleaning. We heard an excerpt from Crossed Out Seasons of Memory by Nankana. The Melting of the Sun by St. Vincent. Open Module by Silicon Prairie. Jen Cutler did Long-Term Memory Loss. We heard Donna Said by Partner. The Ramble by Cassandra Jenkins. Oil on the Phone by Saxo Plus AI. Techno Human Memories, Thoughts and Imagination Exist Where by Shmoo. Figure 8 by Body Negative. I Was Only a Child by Australian Art Orchestra. Ben Varian did One Note Blues. We heard Breathe My Name by Peter Cottontail featuring Jamila Woods. Indictor by Enlinx. Movement 2 by Floating Points featuring Pharoah Sanders and the London Symphony Orchestra. Slow Wave by James McAllister. And in the background now, that's Losing Something by Lost Girls. That's Jenny Havall and Hubbard Holden.
This week on Folk Radio, we'll welcome back producer and player David Mansfield with his friends and Fallout Shelter guests, Rochelle Garnier, Mary Lee Cortez, and Eric Roscoe Amble, Catherine Russell, and Amy Helm.
I loved you the minute you walked through the door, started humming a love song, hummed it sweet and slow. Your eyes